The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 9.
The human sacrifice is over in seconds. Iris is the kind of priestess who believes in running a tight ship, and the tiny body stops thrashing mercifully fast. She lowers the bloody knife to the altar below the foot of the bed, and what happens next is concealed from me. I lie back and screw my eyes shut, but blocking out the sight of what they're doing doesn't make things better. I can feel blind things moving in the darkness, all around, scraping and scrabbling at the porous walls of the world. They're trying to get in. I invited them, and many of them have found bodies, but those that haven't, there are myriads of them. What have I done? I'm not sure. I'm not sure of anything, except horror and disgust and a sense of nauseous unease at my own body. I'm lying on a bed, surrounded by corpses, at the exact end of a ley line that connected the capital with its dead underbelly, the citadel of silence in the English countryside. And they're trying to do something awful, using me as a vessel, but it failed. Just like my attempt to use the energy of my own death to summon the eaters in the night.
By the blood of the newborn be you bound to this flesh, this body, and this will.
Iris's voice is a dissonant screech like nails on a blackboard, compelling and revolting, impossible to ignore. I open my eyes. She stands beside the bed, holding the silver goblet before my chin. It's full to brimming with dark fluid, thick and warm and amazingly wonderful to smell, and I finally twig. That's not wine. I try to turn my head away, but two of her followers grasp me with gloved hands and push me up, straining against the ropes and brutally stretching my sore arm.
I command you and name you, Eater of Souls and Master of Erdeni Zu. I name you again, Heir of Burdakovsky's Flesh, and I bind you to service in the name of the Black Pharaoh, Nyarlathotep.
Then they pry my jaws open and stick a funnel in my mouth and start pouring while some bastard grips my nostrils shut, giving me a choice between drowning and swallowing.
There,
says Iris, smiling at me as she hands the half-empty goblet to her daughter.
Isn't it so much better now?
I roll my eyes, force saliva, and spit. I'm not aiming at Iris, I'm just trying to clean the taste from my tongue, but her smile slips.
Hey now, I didn't give you permission to do that. No spitting. Do you understand?
I bite my tongue before I succumb to the impulse to tell her where to shove it. I want to be rid of these ropes. There are things waiting outside in the dark, learning once again how bones and sinews are articulated, and I don't want to be tied up down here when they arrive. Her words of binding slide over and past me, like a fishing line with rotten, unappetizing bait. But if I really was the Eater of Souls, they'd sink into my inner ears like barbed wire kisses. The only way out of here is to convince Iris that her little ritual worked. I'll just have to pretend.
I understand,
I croak after a brief pause, and it's not hard to sound utterly unlike myself.
Mistress.
The fat, happy smile begins to steal back across her face.
Here are your orders. You will serve the goals and rules of the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh. You will not attack or attempt to damage any of the Brotherhood under penalty of the binding I hold over you. You will not reveal your true nature to anyone outside the Brotherhood without my permission. And you will inform me at once if you suspect you are under suspicion. Do you understand?
That's a no-brainer.
Yes, mistress,
I say, looking her in the eyes. Her face has an unhealthy greenish sheen to it, as if there's an ethereal light source behind me. She's really sucking this up.
Good,
she nods to her minions.
Untie him.
They bend over the black cords that bind me, and as they loosen, I feel a very strange sensation in my chest, a gathering sensitivity, an awareness of the darkness around me. The ropes, part of the ritual apparatus prepared by the Brotherhood of the Skull for their own purposes so long ago, held their own gesh. It made me feel weak. But now they're gone, the sense of strangeness redoubles. I'm an alien in my own body. It's very disturbing.
Can you stand?
Iris asks me.
I'll try.
First, I try to sit up, using my left arm as a lever. It's clumsy and I'm physically unbalanced, and my right arm is still throbbing distantly, but I succeed. Throwing a leg out sideways, I crab round, then lean forward, and, with a silent apology, slide across the back of the mummified sleeper under the counterpane. Is it my imagination, or do they twitch and push back at me? I don't stop to find out, but continue sliding my feet towards the floor. It's like standing for the first time after being bedridden with a fever. At first, it takes all my energy, and I nearly black out. Everything goes grey for a few seconds, and there is a buzzing and chittering in my ears. But then my head clears, and I find I feel fine. I feel fine. And the feeling extends beyond me, beyond the walls of the crypt, out into the damp soil and among the tree roots and into the cavities encysted in the ground, their occupants now waking from their long slumber.
I'm standing, I say, swaying slightly.
Good.
Iris turns towards the altar.
Behold, the Eater of Souls,
she says, and takes my left wrist and holds it up, for all the world like a referee hailing a winning boxer.
What would you have me do now?
I ask her out of the corner of my mouth, hamming it up for the benefit of the audience.
Nothing yet, but I have sent out a summons to our brethren. Next month we will hold another rite, and you will open the way to the gatekeeper. If all goes well, the Pharaoh shall walk Earth's ground again next March. Do you think you can do that?
Silent voices tickle the back of my skull.
What would you have us do, Lord?
I tell them precisely what I want, in pedantically detailed Enochian, a dead language with which to command dead things.
Eater, speak.
Iris stares at me. We're close enough that I can see that greenish glow reflected on her face.
Oh, it's me.
I'm glowing, I realize. My eyes are glowing. I'm possessed. I look at her.
Iris, I say softly, you've forgotten the first rule of applied demonology.
She stares.
How did you know my...
Do not call up that which you cannot put down. She tries to jerk her left hand away from me, making a grab at her improvised altar with her right. She reaches for the blood-tarnished silver sacrificial sickle, but I yank her back and bring my right hand up to catch her wrist. We stand for a second in a parody of a waltz step, and I smile at her, baring my teeth. Her expression of heart-struck terror is as pure as fresh-shed blood. Around us, her followers are turning, beginning to realize something has gone wrong, as the voices at the back of my head whisper oaths of fealty to me, and the feeders bend to their tasks. I raise my right arm, painless now, over her head, and spin her round, then gather her to my chest, with my mouth centimeters from the nape of her neck. I'm careful not to make contact with her bare skin. A strangely irresistible aroma rises from her, and I suspect if I touched her, I'd be unable to control myself. She smells of food.
Nobody try anything, I shout, or I'll kill her.
A couple of the cultists are armed, but their security guys seem to favor shotguns, not the ideal weapon for dealing with a hostage taker if you want the hostage back in anything other than lots of little pieces. Simultaneously, there's a stifled scream, and Jonquil falters in the act of raising a knife to throw at me.
The bed,
she hiccups. Yes, fear gives some people the hiccups.
Look at the bed.
Shut up, Iris begins to say, as I twist us both round so that I can see what everyone else is looking at. Then she falls silent. A man near the back of the congregation yells,
Run for it!
He grabs his robe and legs it in the direction of the doors. In front of my eyes, on the bed and everywhere else I can sense around me, the dead are rising.
Alpha 20, this is Charlie Mike. Do you receive? Over. Charlie Mike, Alpha 20, receiving you clear. Over.
The Eurocopter EC-135 banks gently as it turns towards Brookwood. Behind it, the streetlights of Guildford sprawl across the North Downs like a gigantic luminous jellyfish swimming in deep waters. Ahead, the ground is dark and peaceful until Woking, another amber-pricked sprawl of suburbia sleeping lightly in the summer night.
Alpha 20, are you in visual range yet? Over. Charlie Mike, 2 miles out and closing. No lights on the ground. Over.
Alpha 20, roger that. We recommend night sun. Focus is any parked vehicle on side roads off cemetery pales. We're looking for a Mercedes 500 SL, color silver. Over.
The police sergeant sitting in the back seat with the controls to the infrared camera is peering into his screen, searching the tree-lined darkness for any sign of life. Tracking down the straight boulevard that leads through the park-like cemetery, his eyes are drawn to a row of vehicles parked off to one side of a crescent-shaped side road.
Got vehicles, he says, tweaking the joystick to turn his camera and zoom on them.
Location, St. Barnabas Avenue, adjacent to building and clearing to south of road.
Jesus!
The bright pinpoints of bodies are clearly visible on his camera. They're moving around in the woods northeast of the building, and a couple south of the building, and there are flares moving fast, bursting like fireworks.
Alpha 20, we see fireworks. Repeat, fireworks. Numerous parties. Situation confused. South St. Barnabas Avenue. Climbing to flight level 20. Over.
The ground drops away, and the airframe throbs as the pilot pulls up on the collective pitch and climbs at full power.
Roy, what's going on down there? He asks over the intercom. Not sure, Skipper. Looks like rockets.
There are dark pinpoint figures down there, what looks like a mob, but they're not showing up as heat sources.
Something wrong with the camera, dammit. There are people down there, but I think the rockets are masking their body heat. Never heard of that. You can use the night sun once we're above 3,000 feet. Clear? Got it. Tell me when. Jesus, that was big. They set a tree burning. Oh, Jesus fucking Christ, I've never seen anything like it. Sir, there's a whole crowd down there, and the idiots with fireworks are aiming at them.
Hit the switch when ready. We need to see this.
The observer hits the power switch on the night sun searchlight. 30 million candle power dialed to maximum area washes over the churning landscape of the cemetery, turning night into day.
Alpha 20, this is Charlie Mike. Do you have a sit rep? Over.
Charlie Mike to Alpha 20, major incident in progress. Illegal fireworks, also major crowd control issue, vegetation on fire. Center of disturbance is the chapel on St. Barnabas Avenue, but the crowd, they're everywhere. Is there an illegal rave? Request backup, major incident team, plan red, over.
Half a mile up the road, a red fire control truck has pulled up just outside the entrance to the cemetery, blue light strobing. A small army of police cars are streaming in behind it, converging from every point of the compass, breaking the amber-lit monotony of the roads with red and blue flickers. The observer in the back of Charlie Mike zooms in with his FLIR camera, focusing on the crowd, frowning.
Skipper, I don't know how to put this, but a lot of the bodies down there, they're showing up cold. I mean, stone cold. I can see them by night sun, but they ought to be in hospital with hypothermia. Know what I mean?
Over the century and a half for which it has been open for business, roughly 250,000 funerals have been carried out in Brookwood. Many more cremations have been held, and many older graves have been disinterred and their occupants moved piecemeal to the ossuaries. But the ground still holds more souls than the nearby towns of Guildford and Woking combined. The cemetery grounds are churned like newly mown fields, but no birds will chance this terrain in search of earthworms and grubs. Below the helicopter, thousands of eyeless faces look up. They stand where they have risen, strange fruiting bodies sprouting from the decay-riddled earth, in concentric circles that ripple outwards from the chapel of the ancient and honourable Order of Wheelwrights. Their withered faces track the helicopter as it spirals overhead, shattering the night with a thunder of blades. Among them, a handful of warm bodies still move, desperately trying to form a defensive line around the chapel. But one by one, the pinpoints of warmth and life are going out. The strobing blues cast ghostly shadows across the interior of the Oculus truck as it sits at the entrance to the graveyard, engine idling. Warrant Officer Howe and his paramedic, Sergeant Jude, are sitting over Angleton's supine body.
Flatline, Jude says phlegmatically. He's breathing and his heart's beating, but there's nobody home. Might be a stroke, but if so, it's a big one.
Jude's specialty is trauma, especially violent trauma. He's rusty at this end of the game. Wish that ambulance would hurry up.
It's too big a coincidence, Moe says harshly.
You diagnose enemy action? Asks Barnes.
Absolutely. We're on our way to retrieve...
She glances around the cabin.
Among other things, a document of binding.
And there's that.
She gestures forward through the windscreen at the churning night beyond the gates. What are the odds that he'd blow a gasket right at the critical moment? Alan Barnes thinks for a moment, then nods vigorously.
All right, Doctor. Assuming you're correct, how do you think I should deal with the situation? We came expecting to deal with cultists and a possible hostage rescue, not the Night of the Living Dead. There are certain tactical issues to consider.
He nods at the windscreen.
Notably, A, how we get through the crush to wherever our cultists are holed up. B, how we deal with them when we arrive, bearing in mind that our arrival is not going to be terribly stealthy. And C, how we get out alive afterwards. I should say that the possessed are your department. We've got a scorpion stare interferometer, but that's an area denial weapon. Wouldn't do us much good to burn through the walking dead and catch Mr. Howard in the sweep, would it?
He looks at her expectantly.
Do you have any recommendations?
Mo squints at the windscreen. If this truck can get close to the chapel, you've got a link to the police helicopter?
Yes. Why?
Mo looks up at the hatch in the roof of the driver's cab. I need to be able to see what's going on, she says. We need to find the center of this summoning and kill whatever's responsible. Can you give me something to stand on?
You're thinking of...
Alan looks at her violin case.
That's not terribly safe.
Can you think of a better idea?
Mo bares her teeth in something not too unlike a smile.
Because I'm fresh out of subtlety right now.
As long as we keep moving ahead and they don't come climbing over the bodywork, it ought to get us in close,
Howe says slowly.
Sir, if we ride topside with entrenching tools to keep them off her... Very good.
Barnes nods jerkily. He looks at Angleton, unconscious but breathing.
We can't wait for the ambulance, he says finally.
To Howe.
Offload him. Jude, you wait with Dr. Angleton. Howe, you want to leave a guard? Sir, MacDonald, you're staying with Jude and the doctor until the ambulance shows up. Once he's on his way to hospital, wait here. If the trouble overflows, leg it. We'll pick you up later. Clear?
MacDonald, short, wiry, still dressed as a fireman, nods.
Can do. Okay, get the stretcher and jump to it. Williams, get Dr. O'Brien's instrument patched into the external sound system. Scary, collect two shovels and get up top. Let's move it.
Minutes later, the truck rolls slowly towards the gates of Brookwood and the heaving darkness beyond, three figures crouched on its roof. Two of them hold collapsible shovels with sharpened edges. The third clutches something bone white in her hands. She lowers her bow until it kisses the strings of her instrument. The walking dead turn to listen as Mo plays her lullaby. Beyond them, in the darkness, the screams are getting fainter. Here's what I see in the crypt. The dusty counterpane on the altar bed falls away as the two mummified lover sacrifices sit up. They glow with a pallid green of bioluminescence from within, their empty eye sockets writhing with a nauseating slow-motion churn as they look around. Bony metatarsals click on the flagstones as they rise to their feet. A bunch of the cultists are fleeing, making a dash for the iron-studded door. They don't care whether they end up on Iris's shit list. They're more scared of the walking dead. A male cultist, still robed and bearing one of their shotguns, is the first to show some balls. He moves into a firing line on one of the rising dead, bringing his gun to his shoulder. He aims, and fire gouts from his weapon. Indoors, reflected and reverberating from stone, a fired shotgun hammers your eardrums with spikes of compressed air as sharp as knives. I see people shouting, and Iris spasms and screams in my grip, but I hear nothing but echoes from that dreadful report. The walking cadaver's head vanishes in a spray of bone and parchment, but still it stumbles forward, straight towards the shotgun-aiming guard. He stares at it in disbelief, then lowers his aim and fires again, blasting a hole in its thoracic cavity. The truncated revenant falls, but its arms and legs are still moving. Another cultist, one of the ones who stripped for Iris's disastrous summoning, dances forward, holding up a billet of wood. He smashes it down on the twitching remains, raises it, prepares to bring it down again. The mortal remains reach out, and one bony fingertip scrapes the inside of his calf. I can feel what happens. The glory of satiated hunger, the sensual, almost erotic sense of dissolution
as the feeder in the night moves from the parched, damaged host to this new playground of sensual corporeality, driving down and digesting its former owner's identity, submerging him in a tide of white noise. It only takes a split second. I make eye contact with the possessed one. I recognize the glow at the back of his eyes, a reflection of my own refulgent glory. I nod at the shotgun bearer, who is sidling carefully around the bed, clearly stalking the other cadaver, and mouth, "Take him." The syllables my tongue curls around are not English, nor any other language routinely spoken by human beings. The feeder blinks with delight at being so honored as the vehicle of my will, and then he begins to move. Perhaps 5 seconds have passed since the man at the back shouted, "Run for it," and broke for the door. What Iris and those cultists who aren't fleeing see is probably something like this. They see the Eater of Souls, newly risen from his bed, grab their high priestess and whirl her around in a deadly embrace, warning them to stand back. Then, the skeletal remains on the bed sit up. One of them stands and begins to advance on the congregants. A guard shoots its head off, then blows the still-walking corpse in half at the waist. A member of the chorus bashes it twice with a length of wood. He freezes for a second, then hurls the timber at the guard's head and leaps. The other feeder hobbles out from behind the four-poster bed. It's halfway up the stepped ring of mattresses, and it's moving towards the exit. Meanwhile, the mob of terrified cultists have gotten the door open, and that's when the real panic begins. Iris is shaking, but I force her to turn, holding her so that she can't look away. "This is your doing," I shout in her ear, barely able to hear my own voice. Harsh words force themselves through my larynx, words that come without my willing them. "Death waits you. You're all going to die. You have signed an oath of obedience to your dark master, and with hell you are in agreement. Death awaits you all." Her congregation numbers perhaps 30 to 50 at most, with another 8 to 10 on guard outside. The wheelwright dead, in contrast, number in the hundreds, and the honored dead of the Skull Brethren certainly outnumber Iris's followers. I can feel the feeders waiting outside the door, eager for the warmth they can sense within. "Wait for my word of release," I tell them. Eager? Sense? I'm not sure those words are applicable to feeders. I'm not sure feeders are conscious in the way that we are, or even as aware as mammals or birds. They're bundles of rough reflexes, bound together by the strange grammars of night, more like software agents than anything that's ever had flesh. But if it walks like a lizard and breathes gouts of fire, you might as well call it a dragon, and the feeders certainly seem to prefer bodies with a bit of metabolic energy and structural integrity remaining. Behind me, the first feeder completes his leap, slamming chest first onto the floor with a bone-snapping crack. The shotgun-toting guard is reeling from the thrown baton as the feeder lashes out and grasps him by the trouser hem, yanks him closer, and touches skin to skin as the butt of the shotgun descends with force born of panic. In front of me, the other feeder lurches towards a robed woman. She's made of sterner stuff than the ones who are panicking, or perhaps she's just running her anti-rapist self-defense training script on autopilot. She raises a highly illegal taser, and there's a snap and a blue flare as she zaps the feeder. The cadaver collapses like a marionette with its strings cut, its rider temporarily banished back from whence it came. Beings who are basically patterns of energy, bleeding through from a parallel universe to ours, don't respond well to high-voltage electrical noise. A femur goes rolling underfoot among the panicking congregants, triggering a rush to avoid touching it. "Wimps," I think contemptuously. "Shoot her," I instruct my surviving feeder. The feeder raises the shotgun, its butt sticky with a mat of blood and hair, and tries to aim it in the general direction of the door. But its musculoskeletal control is patchy. It has taken 3 hosts in less than 30 seconds, all in different states, and it's confused. The shotgun pitches up as it clumsily jerks the trigger, and there's a repetitive stabbing pain in my ears as it blasts away at the ceiling above the crowd. They've got the doors open, and they're trying to run away. "Stop firing," I tell it, as the panicking cultists scramble for the exit. "Shut and barricade the door behind them."
I can see a hooded female, eyes staring back at me and full of hate. It's Jonquil. She mouths something, probably some variation on, "I'll be back," but she's not going to stay in a locked crypt with the Eater of Souls, even to save her mummy dearest. That's the trouble with cultists. No moral fibre to speak of.
Iris tenses as her followers leave, and it's then that she makes her bid for freedom, stamping hard on the inside of my right shin and trying to elbow me in the guts.
"Let me go," she shouts.
I feel the pain in my leg as if from a great distance, and the elbow in my abdomen is just a mild nuisance.
"I don't think so," I say, and tighten my grip on her. "You don't know what's going on out there," I add.
She keeps struggling, so I force her face down on her own altar.
"You made a really big mistake," I explain, as the feeder with a shotgun stalks after the last fleeing worshipper and reaches for the door. "Fuck you," she snarls.
The feeder with the shotgun draws the door shut.
"You may rise now," I call silently to the ones who wait patiently outside,
and I feel them begin to stir in their niches, shaking the cobwebs from their uneasy bones.
"You made several procedural mistakes, Iris."
I don't need to shout now, but my ears are still ringing.
"You tried to summon up a Pretor, but it didn't occur to you to check first to see if it was already incarnate, which it was, leaving you with an invocation and no target. So it latched onto the first available unhomed soul in the neighborhood, and it just happened to be mine. You're an idiot, Iris. You bound me into my own body, and you've just killed us both."
She's still tense, but she stops struggling. She's listening, I think.
"You've killed me because I... You know what happens to demonologists who run code in their head? You made a big mistake giving me time to think about what was happening. Suicide invocations are always among the most powerful, and you put me in the middle of the biggest graveyard in the country with all that untapped necromantic go-juice. Bet you thought it would make your summoning easier, didn't you? Well, it worked for me, but I'm dead, Iris. I don't know how long this binding is going to hold up, and when the field collapses, I'll be just another corpse."
The ringing in my ears is subsiding, almost enough to hear the muffled banging and screams from outside the door.
Oh dear, it sounds as if they want in again. Can't those people make up their minds? "I don't believe you," she says. "Ford's report..."
Angleton arranged it. He knew we had a leak. Amsterdam proved it, but he'd already spotted the classic signs. He briefed Dr. Mike to put out a plausible line in bullshit, intending to drive you guys into a frenzy of self-exposure. I don't think he expected you to go quite this far, trying to bind the Eater of Souls and turn it loose inside the laundry, though. She's shivering. Fear or rage, I can't tell. Not that it matters. Dimly and distantly, I realize that fear and rage is what I should be feeling, but all I seem to be able to muster up right now is a vague, malevolent joy.
"Ah, Schadenfreude. Fetch the taser," I tell my minion.
I could kill her, but she knows too much. So I need to lock her down until the 7th Cavalry arrive, even if I fall apart before then. And maybe get us the hell out of this crypt before the things in the air tonight get loose and come looking for me.
"How are you doing this?" she says in a loud whisper. "You shouldn't even be alive."
"I'm one of them, Iris, weren't you listening? I'm possessed, recursively."
"Take aim," I tell my feeder. "You don't want this one, she tastes bad."
Which is, on the face of it, nuts. I've never heard of such a thing. But we learn something new every day, don't we?
I let go of her abruptly and step clear to give my minion a clear line of fire. She straightens up and begins to turn, and I realize I miscalculated as she raises her sickle. I duck as she lets fly, and the feeder shoots, all at the same time. Iris collapses. Something nicks my shoulder and falls off.
"Stand back," I tell my feeder. Then I walk over to the bed and collect the black sacrificial cords.
The sickle did some damage, I realize, and I appear to be bleeding, but I can worry about that once I get Iris tied up. By the time I finish binding her wrists and ankles, I'm beginning to feel oddly weak. The noises outside the door to the crypt have died down.
"Go to sleep," I tell my feeders. They crawl and writhe outside in the tunnels, happy and replete with a feast of new flesh,
and need little urging to fall into a state of torpor. It's becoming hard to think clearly. I know there's something I ought to be doing, but... oh, that. I take the ring-bound black folder from Iris's improvised altar and tuck it under my arm. Then I look at my patient feeder, who stands by the altar with a vacant expression, his eyes luminous in the dark. Go to the entrance to the chapel. Open the doors. A truck will come with men. Lead them here, then sleep. He turns and shuffles towards the door, grateful and obedient to the Eater of Souls for granting him this brief existence. Then I am alone in the crypt with Iris, who has begun to recover from her tasering and tries to squirm aside as I walk past her to the bed. Hasta la vista, I tell her. Give my regards to the auditors. Then I keel over on the dusty black satin sheets, dead to the world. There is chaos in the chapel as the cultists desperately prepare to defend the perimeter. On the roof, the surviving guards, Benjamin is not among them, have taken up positions around the corners, pointing their guns out at the sea of bodies that slowly shuffle towards the building. Below them, the worshippers on the ground mill and rush in near terror until three of their number, better organized and equipped than the rest, gather them into groups and set the unarmed to dragging pews into position to form an improvised barricade, while those who bear arms prepare to defend against the creeping wave of darkness. Crouching behind the gargoyle at the southwest corner, Michael Digby, orthodontic technician from Chelmsford, glances sideways at the cowled head of his principal, the sergeant-at-arms responsible for the coven's guard. What are we going to do, sir? He asks quietly.
What does it look like, soldier?
Clive Morton, retail manager from Dorking, studies the darkness with dilated pupils. Digby looks back to the field of fire in front of the chapel, as a brief snap of gunfire knocks over a clump of drunkenly walking figures that have shuffled out of the long shadows cast by the floodlights in the chapel doorway.
Looks like zombies, sir. Thousands of them.
Right, and we're going to hold out here until dawn, or until All Highest figures out how to drive them away, or we run out of ammunition. That answer your question?
You mean the only plan is to stand behind a few feet of church benches?
Beats having your soul eaten.
Down below them, the worshippers have dragged the bench seats into position in an arc around the entrance and steps leading up to the chapel. Their fellows inside the building have lifted up the heavy wooden tables and tipped them against the windows, barring entry. They think they're safe, as long as the armed men on the roof can pick off any shuffling revenants that enter the circle of light. But death is already among them. Alexei, from Novosibirsk, idles in the darkness behind the worshippers, lurking in the vestry where a cultist guard now lies beneath a pile of moth-eaten curtains. Alexei is seriously annoyed, but professionally detached from the cock-up and chaos going on around him. The operation has not gone in accordance with earlier plans. He has, as expected, succeeded in infiltrating the vestibule area, the seething chaos outside, accompanied by a panicking mob erupting from the depths of the chapel, has made things run much more easily than anticipated, up to a point. But the ward around his neck is hot to the touch, smoking faintly with a stench of burned hair. And his radio has clicked three times, panic signals from soldiers unable to take their assigned places. Once is happenstance, but twice is enemy action, and thrice is a fuck-up. Something has gone wrong, and he can no longer count on backup from Yuri and Anton. Finally, as if all of that isn't bad enough, the dead are rising. This latter item, Alexei thinks, is deeply unfair. He's a sergeant in Spetsgruppe V, a professional in other words, and when he kills someone professionally, he expects them to stay dead. These walking abominations are an insult to his competence. If it wasn't for their annoying habit of infecting further victims through touch, they'd be a trivial obstacle at best. As it is, with his ward and his full-body insulated clothing, not to mention his Ostblock ballistic knife, AKM-100 assault gun, and other tools of the trade, he's well-equipped to deal with them. Except that there are too damned many, and they won't stay dead, and the rest of his team are dispersed and in trouble. Speaking of trouble, here comes more. Most of the cultists are wearing black robes, or stupidly inappropriate army surplus camo gear for the guards. If it's naked and you can count the ribs, it's probably one of the risen dead. bonus points for shuffling like a stockbroker on a stag night, and big booby prize if you let it get so close you can see the green luminosity writhing in the depths of its eye sockets. Alexei melts into the shadows behind the figure climbing the steps from the crypt. It's wearing a robe and shuffling drunkenly, and he's about to slide the blade of his knife between its two uppermost cervical vertebrae when he realizes that it is not, in fact, one of the possessed, which raises some interesting questions. A moment later, his gloved hand is covering the climber's mouth, and his knife is at her throat.
"Say nothing," he grunts, tugging her backwards into the vestry. "You won't live, yes? Be silent."
The cultist stumbles as he drags her into the shadows, but doesn't say anything. Alexei rolls her to the ground and has her pinioned in a second.
"Where is All Highest?"
he demands, in heavily accented but serviceable English.
"Downstairs, with the Eater of Souls."
The young woman stiffens for a moment, then sags bonelessly. Alexei rises, wraps himself in the cloak that she won't be needing anymore, and wipes his knife on the back of her dress. Then he tiptoes towards the steps down to the crypt. If the Eater of Souls is lurking downstairs, he reasons, then it's very probable that what he came for is to be found there, and Alexei doesn't give up easily. To the north, a red truck creeps along a darkened avenue. Three figures sit atop its roof. One of them holds a white electric violin. Her two guards watch and wonder, entrenching tools raised and ready to shovel mortal remains off the roof should any such encroach. The truck bumps slowly along in low gear, pushing through a sea of withered bodies that sway and jostle slowly. Occasionally there is a crunch or crackle as the truck rolls over bones that fail to get out of its way in time. The driver doesn't speed up or slow down. To stop in the middle of this unnatural crowd is to court disaster, although none of the feeders has so far attempted to climb aboard the Oculus truck. Down in the darkened truck cab, Major Barnes rides next to the driver, peering into the darkness for any sign of ambush. He talks into his headset.
200 meters in. Dr. O'Brien, do you see any sign of survivors?
Mo, atop the cab, raises her bow.
Not right here, she says shortly.
The walking dead are undirected. The grounded metal framework of the truck blocks their ability to sense those who ride within, and the warm meat on the cab roof is out of easy reach. A crack of gunfire sounds. Mo looks round sharply as Hal grabs her shoulder.
Down, he snaps,
and she ducks as he raises his MP5 and squints through its night sights. The gunfire is coming from a chapel, half concealed by trees and the silent army of walking corpses. There are more shots, followed by shouts and a scream, cut off short.
Shooters on the building roofline, Hal reports. Five bodies. Defenses at ground level, barricades. I can't see anyone manning them. The crowd's thickest there. Defenders have... No, wait.
Cold flesh, bodies that do not show on infrared, have formed an abhuman pyramid to one side of the chapel. The survivors on the roof are shooting, but not at the Oculus truck. They have problems that are closer to hand. As one corpse disintegrates, another takes its place, and the defenders have fewer banishment rounds than the Brookwood has open graves.
Doc, can you do anything about them? Hal asks, because I don't think we're going to get in there without...
Mo raises her bow, strikes a shivering note from the burning strings. Hal winces and moves aside.
Give me some elbow room, she says flatly.
Then she touches the strings lightly, coaxing an eerie, familiar leitmotif from her instrument.
Put this out through the PA circuit, she mutters, grimly determined.
Down below, Barnes grimaces tensely and twists input dials on the truck's external public address systems. The growing wild resonance of Die Valkenrit floods from the big speakers mounted to either side of the cab. The driver looks sidelong at his CO, then floors the accelerator in low gear, adding the roar of the big diesel and the crunch of unburied bones to the music. Barnes announces to the back of the truck,
All right, gentlemen, this is going to be an opposed entry, and they know we're coming. Wards up, arms up. Party time in 60 seconds.
The risen dead are fleeing, for the most part, out of the way of the truck, as it roars and bucks across the path. It's the music that does it. Mo stands atop the roof, utterly engrossed in tracking the melody. Richard Wagner, it was said, hated violinists. Blood drips from her fingertips as the eerie, extra-dimensional resonances of her interpretation of one of his most famous works drags the sound of an entire string section and a brassy resonance echoing from the metal flanks of the truck into being. The truck crunches across skeletal remnants that lie in rows around the chapel, silent and unmoving. A few bodies, less damaged than the rest, lie near a minivan. Others are clustered near the door to the building, which is ajar. A few less emaciated figures lie among the skeletonized forms. Of these, most bear the signs of gunshot wounds.
"Back us up to the door," Barnes tells the driver.
Switching to the common channel.
"All right, we're going in. Standard entry protocol for mass possession. Scary and Howe, over to you. Dr. O'Brien, time to get down off the roof. You can follow with me once we've cleared the way. See if we can figure out what we're looking at."
The soldiers pile out of the back of the truck, wearing bright yellow hazmat suits, MP5s at the ready. The bodies are packed in so tightly around the steps to the chapel that they dash across rib cages and cloak-swathed torsos on the way to the open door. There's a snap of gunfire from up top. Two of the soldiers drop to their knees and reply with a burst of aimed fire. A black-clad figure tumbles from the roofline. One of the soldiers throws something up and over the eaves. The others take cover as the fragmentation grenade explodes.
"What's up there?"
Mo tries to ask, shouting in Barnes's ear.
"Bad guys,"
Barnes grins hungrily.
"Ah."
He taps the earpiece screwed into his left ear.
"Follow me."
The gunfire from the defenders on the roof has stopped as he steps out of the back of the truck and walks towards the chapel entrance. Mo follows him, her violin raised. They're halfway across the 10-meter gap when a silhouette lurches clear of the side of the building and throws itself towards the major. Barnes raises his HK5 and plants a neat 3-round group in the middle of the assailant's torso. By the time Mo's bow makes contact with an eerily blue-glowing string, the fluorescence in the back of the Revenant's eye sockets has begun to fade.
"Bloody fans, always waiting outside the dressing room."
Barnes cocks his head on one side, listening.
"Dr. O'Brien, this way, now."
They're inside in seconds, and one of the soldiers pulls the tall oak door shut behind them. The chapel hall is full of bodies, the long dead and the fresh draped across one another in promiscuous embrace. Some of the recent bodies are naked. In the soldiers' infrared vision, they still glow with body heat.
"Look sharp, some of them made it to the door,"
Howe comments over the open channel. A couple of bodies still clutch bulky assault shotguns with drum magazines. One, wearing a distinctly more professional camouflage rig than the rest, is holding a Russian AKS-74 rifle. None of them, however, are moving. The feeders have eaten their fill and moved on.
"Trapdoor over here, sir."
One of the troops waves, pointing at a raised door.
"Secure it," says Howe. "Tidily, our boy might still be down there."
He doesn't say what everyone fears. The next living soul they find in this city of the dead will be the first. As the soldiers move in, something runs at them out of the tunnel, frighteningly fast. There's a burst of automatic fire.
"Hold that,"
yells Howe, as the Revenant comes apart in a tumbling rain of dust and bones.
"Batons!"
A pair of troops step forward, holding heavily customized cattle prods before them. Electrical shock rods, customized with signal generators to loosen the grip of extra-dimensional horrors on their walking hosts. There's a snap and crackle of sparks as they test their tools.
"You think he's down there?"
Mo says quietly. Major Barnes nods.
"Cultists. They go to ground for their rituals."
Up ahead, Scary triggers his shock stick, sparking the terminals. He grins at Howe.
"I love the smell of..." "Don't say it, son, unless you want a week on toilet duty." "Oh, Sarge."
He steps forward, bending to follow the lead team into the cellar.
"That's harsh."
There are no living bodies in the tunnel. Some of the possessed are still stirring feebly, their luminous eyes guttering in the darkness. But the flying wedge of soldiers with shock sticks shut them down in short order. It's easier than clubbing baby seals. At the end of the tunnel, they come to an open door. Now there's noise, and the troops take up position to either side of the entrance, ready for a forced entry. But while they're waiting, Dr. O'Brien and Major Barnes arrive. Mo holds her violin, ready for a killing chord. Barnes glances at her, then waves Howe back from the right-hand side of the door.
"What do you think?" he asks quietly.
"It stinks, sir. You saw the Sovkit back there?"
"I did. I reckon we've got company. More to the point, we haven't found our boy yet. Could be a hostage situation."
"Shit. I'll tell Moran to bring up the snoop kit."
Mo's eyes are hollow shadows in the darkness.
"Major?"
"What is it?"
She points at the entrance with a hand half folded around something.
"He's definitely in there."
She unfolds her hand, palm upwards, to reveal the cracked and battered screen of Bob's iPhone, icons glowing balefully in the darkness.
"Got a soul tracker on this thing. He's alive, and he's not alone."
Which is when the screaming starts. Alexei is becoming annoyed. He's been down in the crypt for half an hour, moving with painstaking care. The place is literally crawling with the risen dead, feeding on the dwindling survivors of the Black God slave cult, some of whom have barricaded themselves into the ossuary, with predictable consequences. And only sheer luck and the Revenant's lack of situational awareness has saved him. They don't communicate with each other, don't raise the alarm when he lands among them and lashes out with a sharp-edged entrenching tool, or shoots their neighbors with a silenced pistol firing banishment rounds. It would be good news under other circumstances, but Alexei is acutely aware that he has a serious lack of backup, and a mission that under other circumstances would be hopelessly compromised. The sounds of gunfire from up above had nearly died out 10 minutes ago. Now they're getting louder and more frequent. And there's something different about them. Different weapons, much tighter fire discipline. The new shooters are professionals, but they're not his squad. They're firing NATO-spec ammunition. As it is, it looks like the only way out is in. If he can find somewhere to hole up until morning, he stands a chance of exfiltrating on foot. And if he can meet the mission's core objective, retrieve the missing document, so much the better. And everything looks like it's coming down to this corridor here, and the open doorway gaping blackly at the end of it. Alexei glides towards the entrance, then pauses briefly on the threshold. It's a cul-de-sac, and every instinct warns him not to go in. At least not without a couple of fragmentation grenades to clear the way. But there's a quiet sobbing sound coming from inside. A woman's lamentation. And if the mission target is present, it wouldn't do to cut up hard. He adjusts his goggles, then flashes his infrared torch briefly at the ceiling. A confused jumble of impressions. Bodies. Mattresses arranged in concentric rings around a pit, leading down to an altar. There's a four-poster bed behind the altar. The sobbing comes from a figure on the bed. Sacrificial victim, thinks Alexei. There are bodies, some new and some old. This is not a novelty. The idea of rescuing a victim from the cultists, however, holds some appeal, especially as she might know where they will have taken the mission target. Alexei is Spetsnaz through and through, the product of an incredibly harsh training system, ruthlessly self-disciplined, and trained as a soulless killing machine. But he's also intelligent. A misfit who was a round peg in the square hole of the regular army, and possessed of the romantic streak that leads some men into professional soldiering. Given an opportunity to rescue a damsel in distress and expedite his mission goals at the same time, Alexei will go for the gratitude shag. And who can blame him? It's been a hard night's work. And so he dances down the aisle, leans over the lady tied to the bed, and, holding a knife to the neck of the man lying next to her, who just happens to be me, myself, Bob Howard, asks,
"Woman, you tell, where is Fuller Memorandum? Speak now, or we'll cut throat of all heist."
I lie in the grip of a great lassitude. I've been lying here for what seems like decades, staring with unblinking eyes at the star-pricked canopy of black silk above the skull cultist's altar. I know, distantly, that I am in extreme danger. I'm in the middle of a monstrous summoning, and lying like a drunkard next to a bound but still deadly Iris, while her minions panic and try to fight off the eaters outside the chapel, is not a life expectancy enhancing situation. But I can't move. I don't even feel tired. I feel dead. Some kinds of summoning cause serious physical fatigue, possibly via a mechanism not unlike a mild form of K syndrome, and this would appear to be one of them. The black sky above me, pierced by the flickering light of unfamiliar constellations, blows like a chill wind through my awareness. I've seen this sky before, I realize.
Where?
Oh. Yes, the canopy of the altar bed of the Black Skull mirrors the chill starlight that sluices across the desiccated plain, surrounded by the fence of impaled corpses that I dreamed about. The fence that locks the sleeper in the pyramid in somnolent darkness. I'm not the only one to see that skyscape when I close my eyes, I think. I can feel Iris nearby, her mind slowed and frustrated, defocused by the bindings woven into the ropes that trim the altar of the sex magic cultists that used this chapel before her own people moved in. She's angry, terrified, embittered. I could almost feel sympathy for her if my right arm didn't remind me constantly of what she stands for, who she is. There are the eaters, torpid and in some cases well-fed, resting in their bony chrysalids in the porous earth beyond, and there are other human lives upstairs, some of them familiar. They're coming this way. One of them, not so familiar, is almost here already. Something touches my neck, as a voice speaks in a thick Eastern European accent.
Woman, you tell, where is Fuller Memorandum? Speak now, or I will cut throat of all Heist.
Bastard. I'm lying here helpless, and I can't even tell Laughing Boy that I'm not the All Highest. That and the Fuller Memorandum happens to be snugly jacketed in the folder I'm clutching to my bosom with arms like lead weights. This is not looking good. Close to panic, I try to twitch a finger or blink an eyelid. Anything to reassert control over my own treacherous body.
Untie me and I'll take you to it, says Iris, quick as a flash. Please?
I can just about see her batting her eyelids at Laughing Boy. Then she adds,
you'd better cut All Highest's throat before he wakes up. He was going to sacrifice me.
I try to shout, she's lying! But nothing comes out of my throat. I am not, in fact, breathing, I realize distantly. Am I dead? I wonder. Am I undead? I'm not 100% clear on the clinical definition of death, but I'm pretty sure that lying trapped in my own unbreathing body meets some of the requirements. I don't know about the continuity of consciousness bit, but maybe it's a side effect of the binding ritual they used. If I had my phone, I could go online and Google it, but zombie don't surf. I feel the knife blade move, and I really start to panic.
Yet, it's already dead. You take me for fool. Where is Fuller Memorandum? Tell and I release.
The knife is at Iris's throat. I lie beside her, paralyzed and apprehensive. Iris's breath ratchets harshly through her throat.
The phial All Highest is clutching. Be careful, you don't want to touch his skin by accident.
But she's too late. Alexei, Laughing Boy, pulls the Fuller Memorandum from my hands. As he does so, he makes momentary contact with one of my fingers. And the inevitable happens, because this torpor that's come over me, the torpor associated with the summoning and the control of lesser eaters, and with K syndrome, is symptomatic of something else. I'm hungry. In the back of an ambulance speeding towards the Royal Surrey Country Hospital with lights and siren, an old man opens his eyes and whispers,
"Good job, boy."
The paramedic who is looking at the EEG trace glances at him in surprise. The stroke victim tries to sit up, struggling against the straps that hold him on the stretcher. Then he frowns thunderously.
How long was I out?
He asks the paramedic. Then,
forget that. Turn around. I want you to take me to Brookwood. Immediately.
Seconds later, Barnes and his men come through the door with a strobing flicker of light bombs and a concussive blast of stun grenades. They're ready for business. They've got Mo and her singular instrument ready to suppress any residual occult resistance. But they're too late. The screaming is mine. I'm yelling my throat out. A weird, warbling, abhuman keening that doesn't stop until the squad paramedic gingerly sticks me with a battlefield-grade sedative. Which takes some time. When they find me, I'm lying on a vampire prince's bed, covered in gore, with a lump missing from my right arm, and my eyes rolled up in my head so that only the green glowing whites show. It takes them a while to confirm that I'm safe to approach, and a while longer to get an insulated stretcher down to the chamber and strap me down onto it. Iris is sobbing, cringing away from me as far as the ropes will let her. She can't get very far, though. She's weighed down by the body of the dead Spetsnaz trooper, a black ringbinder lying on the floor beside him. As for Alexei, he's dead, eaten by the thing the cultists tried to make of me. Their sacrifice bit a huge and vital chunk out of my soul. After the power of my death magic ran down, I was all but inert until Alexei unintentionally filled up the hole. I don't think he intended to do that. I didn't intend to do that, certainly. I'm no necromancer. But when they've performed the ritual of binding upon you, trying to turn you into a vessel for the Eater of Souls, you need to eat. Epilogue. On the beach. The mind's eye has a fast-forward button. It's funny, most of the time we don't think about it in those terms. But when you're trying to write down a sequence of experiences, to take a series of unfortunate events and turn them into a coherent story, the mind's eye takes on some of the characteristics of an old-fashioned videotape recorder. Bulky, prone to dropouts and loss, cumbersome and wonky and breakable. So call me a camera and stick a battery in my ear. First, Punin got away. Here's what I imagine happened around the time I was screaming my lungs out on a bed of nightmares. In the back of a shiny black BMW speeding towards Woking, and thence to the motorway south to Dover and the Channel Tunnel, an old man opens his eyes and takes a deep breath.
"That was altogether too close for comfort," he says aloud.
Dmitri glances at him in the rearview mirror.
"With respect, sir, I agree."
His knuckles are white where they grasp the steering wheel, and he is racking up fines from the average speed cameras at an almost surreal rate.
"The men."
Punin closes his eyes again.
"Dead, or they'll exfiltrate. Vasily and the embassy can see to their knees. I am going home to explain this fiasco."
He is silent for nearly a minute.
"We nearly had it all. A transcript of the Sternberg fragment, Fuller's memorandum on binding the Eater of Souls."
"With respect, sir, cultists are always unreliable proxies, and we did get the schemata for the violin, and we weakened the British."
Punin glares at Dmitri.
"Weakening the British is not the goal of the great game. Survival is the goal. We are intelligent men, not panicking rats biting each other as they struggle to escape the sinking ship. They are the enemies of our enemy. Never forget that. It is the cultists' error to imagine themselves beset by foes they can never defeat."
"Like back there?"
asks Dmitri. Punin doesn't answer. They drive the rest of the way to the channel in silence. Second, here's what I know happened. Once I woke up briefly, in a darkened nighttime room, with two beds and a door and a man in a blue suit standing outside the door with a gun. The man in the bed next to me was familiar. He was asleep, and I remember thinking that there was something very urgent that I had to tell him, but I couldn't remember what it was, and the file was missing. Then the alarm went off, and the medics came, and they made me go back to sleep. I don't remember much after that, which is a mercy. The dreams were bad. Mo tells me that for the first week they kept me heavily sedated. If they eased up on the chlorpromazine, I started screaming and trying to eat my own fingers. She visited every day. She sat by my bedside and fed me, spooning mush into my mouth and making sure I didn't choke on it. Angleton recovered much faster. 2 nights under observation, and they released him. Then he heard about me and kicked up a stink. They were planning on moving me to St. Hilda's. Angleton had a better idea of what was wrong with me and refused to take no for an answer. So, after nearly a week in hospital, with my head wrapped in the pink fluffy haze of a major antipsychotic bender, a private ambulance picked me up and deposited me in the village. The village used to be called Dunwich, back before the Ministry of War evacuated it and turned it into a special site. It was allocated to the wartime Special Operations Executive, part of which later became the laundry and inherited this small coastal community with its street of cottages and decaying pier, its general store and village pub. Today, we use it as a training centre, and also as a quiet place for taking time out. There's no internet access, and no mobile phone coverage, and no nagging from head office about timesheets and sickness self-certification. There is a medical doctor, but Janet is sensible and very patient, and has seen an astonishing number of cases of Krantzberg syndrome and other more esoteric sorcerous injuries over the years. They billeted me in a tiny seaside cottage, and Janet took me off the chlorpromazine, substituting a number of other medications, not all of them legally prescribable. MDMA helps a lot when you're suffering from the delusion that you're one of the walking dead. After 3 days, I stopped shivering and hiccuping with fear. After a week, I could sleep again without a nightlight. At the weekend, Mo came to visit. I was glad to see her. She knows what it's like where I've been, to a good first approximation. We spent a lot of time together, just holding hands. It feels very strange, touching someone who's alive. Maybe in another week I'll be able to hug her without recoiling because I'm terrified I'm going to accidentally eat her mind. That's the trouble with this job. Sometimes it chews you up and spits you out. Literally. Mo came back the next weekend too. She says she's trying to get her week's compassionate leave, but the fallout from Iris's actions has been beyond earth-shaking. We'll see. I've been working on this report for a couple of weeks now. This being the village and an internet-free zone, I'm allowed to use a computer and dictation software. Although it's had its CD drive and Wi-Fi chipset removed, the case is welded shut and it's padlocked to an oak desk that weighs approximately half as much again as Angleton's Memex. It beats the manual typewriter hands down, but when I asked if I could take it home with me, the security officer barely managed to conceal his sneer. I suppose there are some loose ends I should tie up, so here goes. We never did find out exactly what happened to any of Panin's men, apart from Alexei, or to Panin himself. You should read my speculations with more than a pinch of salt. I can't even be certain beyond a shadow of a doubt that Panin was behind the theft of the violin report, although theft of state secrets is the sort of thing that the 13th Directorate's parent agency traditionally excelled at. I'm assuming that the elite Spetsnaz infiltration troops assigned to an occult warfare department probably stood more of a chance of escaping alive than the cultists, but we didn't account for all of them either. The scene at Brookwood the next morning was indescribable. I've seen the pictures. It was easy enough to close down the cemetery. Police roadblocks, reports about an illegal rave and graveyard vandalism, a handful of D-notices to gag the more annoying local reporters. But then they had to do something with the bodies. The feeders raised just about everything that wasn't totally dismembered and disarticulated. In the end, they had to bring in bulldozers and dig trenches. They identified some of the cultists, but not Jonquil the Sloan Ranger or her boyfriend Julian. I don't think Brookwood will reopen for a long time. Brains has been given a good talking to and is being subjected to the Security Theatre Special Variety Show for breaching about 16 different regulations by installing beta software on an employee's personal phone, reminding Oscar that if he hadn't done so, they'd have lost the Eater of Souls to a cultist infiltrator appears to be futile. Right now, everyone in admin has joined in the world's biggest ass-kicking circle dance, except possibly for Angleton, who is shielding me from the worst of it. Because they haven't forgotten that I've been a naughty boy too. If it wasn't for me, they wouldn't have needed all those bulldozers at Brookfield, would they? Although Angleton has had a measure of success in pointing out to certain over-enthusiastic disciplinarians that if it wasn't for the feeders I summoned, they'd have had the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh trying to open up a long-distance call to the sleeper in the pyramid, paid in the coin of London's dead. As for the man himself, call him Teapot, call him Angleton, call him Sir. I haven't seen him since I woke up here, and I won't be seeing him until the auditors hear my final report and I go back on active duty. But I have this to say. I used to think he scared the shit out of me, but now I know better. I know what he's like, from the inside. The effects of Iris's botched binding faded fast, and I probably only borrowed a tiny fraction of his power. I didn't know how to use it properly either. But I have been destiny entangled before, and I know what it was like then, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Angleton was in a flat-lined coma for the entire duration of my funny turn. I also learned this much. Angleton isn't bound to the laundry by the ramshackle gesh that Fuller and his fellow eccentric occultists threw together in the 1930s. He's a free agent. Or at least as free as any of us are, be we beasts, men, or gods. The reason he puts up with us? I don't know. It may be long habit. He's lived the life of an Englishman for so long now that he self-identifies as such. But I have a theory. Angleton knows what's coming. He knows exactly what is going to bleed through the walls of reality when the stars burn down from the pitiless heavens and our ever-thinking numbers begin to corrode the structure of reality. And he believes we're his best hope for his own survival. Like I said, the only God I believe in is coming back. And when he arrives, I'll be waiting with a shotgun.
The End. You've been listening to The Fuller Memorandum by Charles Stross, narrated by Gideon Emery. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Sci-Fi Audio recommends Glass House, also by Charles Stross, narrated by Kevin R. Free. When Robin wakes up in a clinic with most of his memories missing, it doesn't take him long to discover that someone is trying to kill him. It's the 27th century, when interstellar travel is by teleport gate and conflicts are fought by network worms that censor personalities, including Robin's earlier self. On the run, he volunteers to participate in a unique experimental polity, the Glass House, an insinuated pre-accelerated culture where participants are assigned anonymized identities. But what feels like the perfect sanctuary soon turns into a trap, placing Robin at the mercy of the experimenters and at the mercy of his own unbalanced psyche. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.